From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Welcome to this week's episode of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. Ever since NAPS has begun broadcasting NAPS Chat, I have felt that the episode preceding July 4th ought to be a tribute to our nation's foundation. In fact, during our first July 4th podcast 3 years ago, we interviewed July 4th parade spectators along Constitution Avenue in Washington, asking about their reflections of the Postal Service. Along that very parade route is the National Archives Building, a facility that houses the sacred foundational documents of the United States of America. There are two statues flanking the building entrance. The one on the left is named Present. It's also known as Future. Chiseled on the base of this sculpture is the phrase, "What is past is prologue." That profound statement means that history sets the context for the present day, and yes, even the future. This week on Naps Chat, we will be viewing a snapshot of the formative days of the United States Postal Service, and our guide is noted historian Professor Joseph Adelman, professor of history at Framingham State University in Massachusetts. Professor Adelman is also project coordinator for the Across America 1776 initiative at the Mahundro Institute of Early American History and Culture at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. The professor has published books and articles dealing with the earliest days of the United States. He is currently working on an epic history of the United States Postal Service. Welcome to Naps Chat, Professor Adelman.
Thanks, Bob, for inviting me. I'm looking forward to chatting with you.
Before we even start, I've been wanting to ask this question for some time. We commemorate Independence Day from Great Britain on July 4th, since on that date in 1776, I believe the Second Continental Congress voted to adopt the Declaration of Independence. Yet, the colonies did not achieve military victory of severing the ties with Great Britain until September 3rd, 1783, when the Treaty of Paris was signed, though the last troops didn't leave New York City till November 25th of that year. Why don't we celebrate our country's birth on September 3rd or on November 25th when the British left?
That is a great question, Bob. There's actually a fairly reasonable academic argument to make that at a legal perspective, independence wasn't made real, wasn't achieved until Britain recognized that independence, right? Throughout the Revolutionary War, the position of the government of Great Britain was that these were colonies in rebellion from lawful British government and not an independent nation. And so it's only with Article 1 of the Treaty of Paris that they recognize that. But we had July 4th on the declaration. And of course, an underlying theme of the revolution is that the colonists, the residents of Eastern North America, didn't need to ask the British permission for much of anything. So when the declaration was adopted on July 4th, that's the date that gets put down on paper, that gets circulated throughout the colonies, now states. And that had been being acknowledged and recognized as the date of independence.
Okay. Let's talk about one of the inheritances left us by the British. That is our postal system. Much of our early postal system was bequeathed by England's Crown Post. What similarities did the early United States Post and the Crown Post system share? And where did the United States system diverge?
So it actually looks very similar in the earliest decade or two of American independence, because it simply just laid on top of what had been the British infrastructure. So the first routes of the U.S. postal system were exactly the same routes that the British had used. The most significant was the route right along the Atlantic coast, what today is U.S. Route 1, which many stretches of which are known as Post Road in some way, shape, or form. So they're using that. And a lot of the people are exactly the same. Many of the British imperial postmasters simply hop from being postmasters to the British, then they are patriots, and so they become postmasters for the American system. And so that happens in a lot of cases. The big difference is not just in terms of loyalty of the system, but in terms of how it's designed for revenue. the British imperial system under that, the colonial post office was meant to generate revenue to support the crown, literally to go into the, to support the crown's upkeep, the royal family. But the various systems that Americans come up with, and then once the Continental Congress takes over, the idea is much more that it's designed to facilitate national communication. And this is what the 1792 Post Office Act, that is usually seen as firmly establishing the post office on solid ground, that's what it was designed for. It was designed to be a communications network to hold together, to bring together the entire nation. It obviously charged fees. It obviously, they thought about bringing in revenue to support it, but it was flipping that equation and thinking of the primary purpose being about communication rather than just, we need to pump this system for money.
There were two chapters in the history of the Postal Service that I'd like to look at. First is the role of our postal system during the years of the Revolution, let's say 1775 to 1783. And then I'd like to look at the years under the Articles of Confederation, which was a period of time when actually the debate over the United States Constitution was being waged. So if we can divide up those two eras of the Postal Service and say, what function did it play during the Revolutionary War? And then what role did it play during the debate over the United States Constitution?
So the Imperial Postal Service became a political hot potato in the mid-1770s. Colonists, patriots began to lump it together. It was designed to generate revenue for the British crown. And so people by the early 1770s started talking about it as yet another tax. It's a way that they're trying to control us. They're censoring us. They're intercepting our letters and trying to read our plans, which was true. They were right about that. The British were doing that. And so there's a bunch of proposals, the most famous of which by a newspaper printer named William Goddard, to create what he called a constitutional post, to create, this is before the war starts, this is a year before Lexington and Concord, that he wants to set up this separate postal system that's going to be independent of the British system, supported by committees of correspondence, these groups that had formed to sort of coordinate patriot activity, and get some play in 1774. Congress considers it, the First Continental Congress, and then decides not to do anything at that point. But after fighting starts in April 1775, so after the battles of Lexington and Concord, the Second Continental Congress meets, and one of the very first things that they do that summer is create a Continental Post Office. It is the third national institution after Congress itself and the Army. It's older than the Navy, it's older than the Marine Corps, it's older than pretty much every other institution of American government. So it's certainly something that they see as vital. They see communication as vital. Of course, during wartime, there's armies out in the field and literally in the way. The New York City Post Office, when the British occupy that city, has to move 25 miles north along the Hudson River to the village of Dobbs Ferry, where it stays for the whole year. So the New York City Post Office is 20 miles outside of New York City because the British are occupying the city. So there's all sorts of communication difficulties getting people through to communicate. Newspaper printers have trouble gathering paper and ink. There were shortages of materials. The post office is seen as so important that Congress exempts many postal employees from military service. But at the same time, the largest population of people who are post riders are young men. And so many of them are taking up arms in one way, shape, or form. So the postal system itself has a, unfortunately for this conversation, perhaps a limited role in terms of the actual war, but both armies, so Washington and the Continental Army, Generals Howe and Clinton for the British Army, are setting up express riders to get back and forth from wherever they are to Philadelphia and the Continental Congress, or to New York and the British headquarters, to communicate with other commanders. So they're making use of these systems and making use of the system in special ways during the war itself. And then if you want to ask another question to sort of set us up for
sure.
Confederation,
okay.
Period,
yeah,
we can do that.
Basically, you know, what changed during the we have independence from the British under the Articles of Confederation. the Postal Service was under the authority of the Congress. What role did the Postal Service play in those days when our Constitution was being debated? Because that happened during the Confederation Congress.
Yeah, so during the Confederation period, there's nothing but Congress in terms of a national government, right? There's no presidency, there's no judiciary, there's no executive branch. So the system is in flux. It's reliant on, because it's able to generate its own revenues, it does a little better, I think, than some other parts of government. One of the big issues for the Confederation government is revenue. The way the articles are designed, Congress is able to ask the states for money, but not require it. And so some states are good about sending money. Some states are not so good. So they're working to, I usually, when I'm talking to people, describe the Acela corridor. In those days, it would be like Philadelphia up to Boston. The system works reasonably well. It's a relatively densely populated coastal region. There's well-populated towns every 15 or 20 or 30 miles along that postal route from Philadelphia to Boston. So the system generates an income, is able to function pretty well. South of there, and especially when you get into places like North Carolina, North Carolina is constantly begging Congress to improve service. The distances are greater between population centers. There's a lot less well-developed transportation infrastructure in terms of getting across the many rivers that, right, the rivers run to the coast. And so a route that runs along the coast needs to cross the rivers. And so there's just problems in the South that they're constantly dealing with. And then, as you mentioned, when we get to ratification of the Constitution, the post office is really key as this communications pathway. It serves as a sort of proto-wire service for newspapers, for the news media, that they send their newspapers through the post office to one another as a way to get news about what's happening in different places across the country. And during the ratification debates, one of the things that happens is that many, if not most, of the newspaper printers and editors were pro-Constitution. They supported ratification of the Constitution. So they're very eager to print pro-ratification essays and news about how well ratification's going, whether it actually is or not on the ground. And the smaller number of printers, editors who oppose ratification are therefore having trouble getting their stories picked up. And one of the things they do is they accuse the post office of suppressing their arguments. And William Goddard, who I mentioned before, who in the 1770s is accusing the British of making life difficult for people with the postal system, writes around to some of his friends and says, the Continental Congress and Ebenezer Hazard, this postmaster general, are doing the exact same thing to us. Some amount of that is exaggeration, simply because the pro-Constitution editors don't want to reprint stories about how awful the Constitution is. Some of it is a little bit of reality, that they're not getting the kind of friendly service that they might otherwise have expected.
Let's fast forward a bit. We have the Constitution. The Constitution is ratified. Why did the authors of the Constitution believe that Congress should have the authority to establish post offices and post roads rather than the President of the United States?
Yeah, so the authority to create offices and roads is right there in Article 1, Section 8, the Enumerated Powers Clause. It seems relatively simple, but they saw that as a legislative function. And the main reason for that is that as much as we were trying to separate from Great Britain, we modeled many of our legal structures in the Constitution after the British structure. And in the British system, Parliament was responsible for legislating and creating post offices and postal routes. Many of the state legislatures in the 70s and 80s, the 1770s and 80s, had taken up that same power within their states to establish routes within their states, sometimes to establish riders to supplement the Continental Post Office. And so it made natural sense for them. It's in the articles that the Congress can do that, and they pull that straight into the Constitution.
Under the Articles of Confederation prior to the ratification of the Constitution, there were three postmasters, one who we know a lot about, and that's Benjamin Franklin.
Yes.
We don't know as much about his son-in-law, Richard Bache, and Ebenezer Hazard. Did the three of them have unique skills that qualified for them for the position of Postmaster General? And how did their authority differ and views of the Postal Service differ from those who followed them, all who were appointed by President Washington?
Yeah, so Benjamin Franklin, who's the first Postmaster General of the Continental Post Office, which becomes the U.S. Post Office, he brought with him 37 years of experience with the British Imperial Post Office. He had been postmaster in Philadelphia and then spent 21 years until he was fired as Deputy Postmaster General for North America under the British Imperial system. He had significant experience. He had, in fact, developed much of the American system. He'd done two full tours from Maine to Georgia of the entire system while he was Deputy Postmaster General. Nobody knew the routes better. Nobody knew the offices. Nobody knew the personnel. He'd appointed many of them. Nobody knew them better than he did. Richard Bache was Benjamin Franklin's son-in-law, and that's about it in terms of his qualifications for holding the office. So he was not a successful occupant of the office. Ebenezer Hazard, though, did have experience with the post office. He had started out in Boston as a bookseller. He moved to New York and worked in the system as the New York postmaster during the war. And so in 1782, Congress gives him the postmaster generalship in place of Richard Bache. Franklin had relinquished it when he left to be the first United States ambassador to France. It was not uncommon in the postal system of that era. It was not uncommon in many offices of that era for what we would describe as nepotism, but for sort of familial connections to be important. And so it made sense that Franklin wanted Bache to take over. And so that was how it happened. But yeah, Hazard served through the era of the Confederation Congress. He sought ways to make sure that the system was profitable, which is a constant theme across time for the post office, is that it's expected, whether or not it's supposed to be generating profits, it's expected to be generating revenue to be paying its own expenses as a government service. It's different from many other government agencies and institutions in that regard.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about Ebenezer Hazard, our third Postmaster General, for a moment. He held the job for 8 years, but he got himself in a bit of trouble with President Washington, which ultimately cost him his position. Interestingly, Hazard was the only federal official fired by Washington upon his election. What cost him his job?
Essentially that he annoyed Washington by appearing to be too partisan. So Washington, a reluctant participant in the Constitutional Convention for a whole variety of reasons, but a supporter of the Constitution and a supporter of a stronger central national government. So what gets Hazard in trouble is this debate about the post office being put to partisan purposes and Hazard being accused of suppressing their arguments. And whether he did or not, he was relatively dismissive of the concerns of these anti-federalists. Washington, as I'm guessing your listeners are familiar with, was super conscious about appearances and very concerned with promoting the legitimacy of the government, and came from a background, and many of the early government leaders did, where at least in theory, they believed that partisanship was by definition bad. That partisanship, that party allegiance in its very existence undermined the legitimacy of government. That the government should be outside of party concerns, because party concerns were personal, were private, and therefore counter to the public interest. Oh, how times have changed. And the irony of 1790s politics is sort of baked into describing that that's the background that many of them have. But what really happened to Hazard is Washington had that perception of, we don't want the government to appear partisan. The government is supposed to be outside of personal interests. It's supposed to be acting in the public interest. Right. And Washington, like most other leaders, thought that he, as a leading wealthy planter, was one of the few Americans in a position to be outside of his own interests. Right. So there's a certain irony in his position as well. But Hazard's arguments with anti-federalists just it proved unseemly for Washington. And so he appoints in place of Hazard Samuel Osgood, who was a loyal Federalist, right, was a political ally of Washington and a Boston merchant. So he's well connected to run the system going forward from 1789.
So Washington thought that PMG Hazard was just too much of a partisan to be PMG.
Yeah, and was therefore undermining government legitimacy.
Let's move after ratification of the Constitution, the Postal Department with the Postmaster General as a member of the cabinet was not created until 1792 with, as you referenced earlier, the Post Office Act of 1792. It's my understanding that prior to the passage of the bill by Congress, then Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton and Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson battled over whether the post office would be under the Treasury Department or under the State Department. Could you talk about that battle?
Yeah, this goes under the category of songs that we wish Lin-Manuel Miranda had written, right? A third cabinet battle of debate about the post office. So it's Hamilton and Jefferson. So it's about power, which, right, isn't it always? Mm-hmm. And money, right? Money is power, which Hamilton keenly understands, and Miranda describes that in the musical. Jefferson essentially was worried that Hamilton was drawing together too much power under the Treasury Department by controlling too much of the financial purse strings. They were both anticipating, because the post office generates revenue, they were both anticipating profits that had yet to show up. They would eventually, but had yet to show up. Jefferson's argument was actually quite clear that the Treasury Department shouldn't have that much power, shouldn't have the power to control that much revenue. Instead, he argued that the post office should be under the Department of State as a part of the domestic operations of government. And the way to remember, we think of the State Department now mostly for diplomacy and foreign service. But if you keep in mind that most states have an office that's a Secretary of State, that's often like the Department or Registry of Motor Vehicles is under the Department of State, elections, right? All sorts of basic functions of government under that office. And that's sort of what Jefferson was thinking. So there's other things that fall in that branch that are not foreign relations, but are domestic relations. So he's not completely out of bounds to make this argument, but he was trying to make the case that it's simply part of domestic operations rather than something that's a revenue function. And he loses. it does become independent, but it stays more closely linked to the Treasury Department than to the State Department.
Yeah, as it is right now, because a lot of the postal legislation we deal with gets signed off by the Treasury Department. I mean, we had under the previous administration, our Secretary of Treasury Mnuchin really extended the loans to or underwritten certain finances by the Postal Service. That relationships exist to this day.
Yeah.
I want to come back to Hazard for a second and just something I noticed in his way of running the postal system and that he shares certain similarities with the present Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, and that is he looked at the transportation system and logistics and tried to change it because, as you referenced, at that time, a lot of the mail was carried by stagecoaches, and they really didn't have the opportunity, stagecoach drivers, to discern between what papers they carry and what papers they don't carry. They carried everything that was carried virtually for free. Mm-hmm. Hazard switched correspondence mail and post mail and newspapers to post riders. You know, so there was a change in the way in which mail was transported because I guess he thought that post riders were more efficient and cheaper. I mean, is that what was going on?
Yeah, a little bit. So before the Revolutionary War, everything is post riders. It's one guy on a horse from one town to the next. So after the Revolution is right at the moment when stagecoach service becomes popular and profitable as a transportation method for people between New York and Philadelphia, between New York and Boston. They're able to make the journey. I forget whether it's a day or a day and a half from New York to Philadelphia, which if any of your listeners have to deal with traffic on the New Jersey Turnpike, it might not feel like it's not that much better now than it was then. But it's a new and faster means of transportation that's commercial services as opposed to just, you know, John Hancock can take his own stagecoach, his own coach, wherever he wants. But this is stagecoaches of thinking of commercially offered services to the public. And so when those start up in the early 1780s, as the war is ending, the postal system, and actually I think it might have been Hazard who did it, contracted with them to carry mail. And this was, it's something that stays common actually through the 19th century. Much of the mail service in vast swaths of the Western United States were run through what were known as star routes in the 19th century, where rather than hiring a post office employee to go be at the office in Nebraska or wherever and running a U.S. post office rider from one stop to the next, they would simply make a contract with a private service for whatever amount of money to do that. So it's a very common thing through the post office, at least through the 19th century and even I think into the 20th. So he's doing that. He then gets into a fight with the stagecoach operators. This is clearly a theme with Hazard, right? That he's not getting along with people very well. And about, he's accusing them, even then the post office has a monopoly on what we would call first-class mail, on letters. And so he's accuses them of slipping in letters on the side outside of the official postal mailbags, outside of the portmanteaus, which is something that happened in the British system, in the colonial system, with some regularity. Sending an actual letter was relatively expensive. And so from time to time, there were post riders who were, in a legal matter, corrupt. They were violating the law, but would carry the letter in a second bag on the side for half the price and just pocket the whole thing. So he's accusing the stagecoach operators of essentially doing the same thing at a larger scale. He's accusing them of favoring their own commercial schedules for carrying passengers when he wants them to be favoring the postal schedule for mail delivery. And so in 1788, he switches back to post riders. So it's efficiency, but it's also about power.
Wow.
And control, and having people he can control rather than the stagecoach operators.
Wow, things don't change over the 200 some odd years. About
there are loud echoes everywhere.
as I began, the past is prologue. I want to thank you for being our guest this week, Professor Adelman. That is Professor Adelman, professor of history at Framingham State University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
I want to thank NapsChat listeners for logging on this week. If you enjoy NapsChat, please leave us a positive review in the Apple Podcast Store. And more importantly, share NapsChat with your friends and colleagues. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great 4th of July.
I'm going to bend right down and right.